Support for the Media Project comes from the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a Master of Arts in Communications to advance careers in media, PR, and journalism. Fuller part-time options, 518-454-5143. And Rosenbaum Media Group, a digital communications agency integrating high-definition video into PR, marketing, advertising, and social media campaigns. Big-picture thinking for local and national clients. RosenbaumMedia.com. From Northeast Public Radio, this is The Media Project, a weekly discussion about issues confronting the media.
Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score. Killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime, and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk. Pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it. It's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press.
So thanks to Pete Seeger with the introduction there. The Media Project is underway. The Media Project, always the best part of it is right here at the beginning, or if we cut the program a little bit short, then we get Pete Moore at the end, which is good.
Yeah.
Alan Shartok is here, Rosemary Armeo, I'm Rex Smith. We are the Media Project from Northeast Public Radio. So, and you actually talk to Pete, don't you, in person?
Pete just called me. He is such a wonderful man. We love him so much, and he's doing a benefit concert for WAMC down in Peekskill, New York, and it's going to be a terrific thing. You know, in the last fund drive, we gave out the tickets as premiums, and I got to say this, it didn't take long.
Yeah.
It didn't take long.
Such a giant, a chance to see Pete Seeger in person. That's a really cool thing. Anyway, on to media issues of the week. There are many. Actually, we should start locally then, if we're talking about down in Peekskill, New York, because right down around that way, one of the major newspapers just got sold. News Corp, as in Rupert Murdoch, has just sold what we used to call the Ottaway newspapers, the Dow Jones local newspaper group, which includes the Times-Herald Record of Middletown, New York, which is a fine suburban tabloid. It includes the Cape Cod Times and the Record in Stockton, California, New Bedford, Mass., the Standard Times, some of the other papers, just sold them to Gatehouse Media, which is a big chain of small papers. And the interesting thing about this, I think, is that there is increasing evidence that publishers see that there is a future in these smaller papers, that the touted death of newspapers seems not to be applying so much to the community newspapers around us.
But the Middletown Record has always been a nice, big, fat newspaper.
Yeah.
And, of course, the Ottaway Group, which you talk about, was run by James Ottaway Jr. and Sr. I have to tell you, I'm a very good friend of, at least I hope I am, of James Ottaway. And he is a magnificent human being. He really is. He's got his head set on straight. He has values, which are wonderful. He was, for a while, the head of Dow Jones and when the paper got sold. And I'm a huge fan. So do you think that this is good news in terms of the people? As you know, I'm not a Rupert Murdoch fan, and I'm wondering whether or not this is going to be an improvement.
It's hard to say because no one really knows what kind of margin the owners, new owners, will expect. But what's clear is that Murdoch has to sell off some of his properties to have the cash that he needs if he wants to hold on to some of the others.
This is his pattern, is he buys new property and gets real interested in it, invests in it, and pays for that investment and interest by selling off stuff that he's bought from before. So getting rid of Rupert Murdoch has to be an improvement. The problem with community newspapers, I do think that there's demand and interest for it, but where's the money? I mean, you got to pay reporters something. I've sometimes thought about chucking it all and going back to work at a small newspaper, community newspaper, like maybe on the border of the country where there's lots of great stories to be told and to have experience would be fun to work there, but I couldn't afford it.
Well,
I couldn't live on it.
No, you really couldn't live on a reporter's salary at or even an editor's salary at a smaller paper.
It's almost becoming like a hobby. You do journalism, you know, in addition to your real job.
Mm-hmm. But a couple of papers, for example, have had some success that are just noted recently. There was an article published by Poynter, the journalism think tank, about the papers in Vermont, the Rutland Times Herald and the Times Argus, which have a combined Sunday print circulation of 18,000, and they've put up a paywall on their website, and they seem to be having some real success. You know, it seems that it's working for them. I think the answer to the question is, where does the money come from? It's lots of the little businesses around the community. In a small town, there isn't as much competition for information as there is in a larger place. So they actually have that niche that we all always talk about journalism enterprises needing these days.
So it's really interesting to think of people changing their habits. I mean, my wonderful wife, Roselle, loves to buy the Sunday Times. But by the time she buys it, I've read everything in it in my frequent nighttime excursions to the Times when I'm waking up. But the real question is, will somebody in a small town take their iPhone, get the app, and read the Berkshire Eagle all day long? And obviously, it's not huge, so there isn't that much in it. It's always interesting. So it's a matter of habit. Will older people who tend to read things on paper, will they go change their way to their iPhones?
That is an issue. There's no question. But I think another issue here is that the small towns are not being covered. It's the lack of content. You can have an app, you can have a smartphone, you can have an iPod, everything, and you're not going to get news, for example, out of Watertown. What's the state? We just were on a tour of the state capitol. Watertown used to have an official in the capitol.
Oh, indeed.
And they would cover all issues of concerned dairy farms or whatever.
A reporter, a correspondent. You said an official. They used to have a correspondent in the Capitol, right?
Exactly. Uh-huh. Yep. So where do they get that news now? They can have, as I say, an iPad or an iPhone. They're still not going to find it.
Well, that goes directly to something that I know Rex is going to, as the moderator, is going to want to bring up with us.
and if he fails to do so.
It's amazing how you two read each other's minds.
It's scary.
And that is the whole idea of the new journalism, which is that people are twitting and tweeting and doing social media, so that's the new journalism. And we're seeing articles in the Times about it way out ahead of what the newspapers may be doing.
It certainly is true. David Carr, the Times media columnist, wrote a piece about how campaign journalism has been transformed by Twitter.
Exactly.
Because every little bit of detail goes out on Twitter as soon as it happens in the campaign.
Right. And it used to be one story. You'd have a whole trail or a whole busload of correspondents who would be traveling around with the candidates, and they would look for a story a day. Mm-hmm. And generally, they would coordinate it because they wouldn't want to miss the real big one story of the day. So it tended to be the same.
Well, and the editors would be demanding it. I've told this story before about following Michael Dukakis. And when I called in to my editor, because this is before the days of cell phones, to say, well, I've just come from this housing event. He was in Cleveland or Cincinnati or one of those, Columbus, and he was doing something about affordable housing. And I said to my editor, okay, I've got the Dukakis housing story, and I thought this would be the one time during the campaign where Dukakis talks about housing, which is an important issue in the domestic economic conversation. He said, can you match the AP story on the flag? What? Well, the AP had a piece. This was this big controversy during that campaign. George H.W. Bush had gone to a flag factory to emphasize the fact that Michael Dukakis, as governor, had vetoed a bill that required students to say the Pledge of Allegiance every morning. I don't recall why he did so, but anyway, he had vetoed the bill, and it became Pledge to the Flag, became a huge controversy. Wearing the American flag lapel pin became big. And my editors were basically saying, I need you to give us the same story that AP has, but under your byline. And I said, well, I wasn't with him when AP talked to him about this. I've got a housing story here. And they said, we'd really like for you to match the flag story. So what ended up happening was my story about housing ended up being about a graph and a half, about 90 words at
Cat
most. And the flag story from the AP ran above it in the paper the next
day. So this, Rex, as a great editor that I know you are, have you ever considered saying that story, which I have now heard? I don't want to confuse you, but I've heard it twice.
Twice.
Yeah, in case people are shutting off the radios and saying, I heard this one already. I wanted I wanted to ask you something, Rex. Have you ever, now be honest.
Yes.
This is an honesty question.
Okay.
You know what an honesty question is, right? Lightning bolt comes out of the sky if you lie.
Oh, okay.
Here we go. Have you ever found yourself in an identical position to that editor who said to you, I want the flag story, knowing intuitively that that's what would get more readers?
Oh, that it would get more readers.
Than the substantive story about the housing, but, you know, yawn.
You're thinking of hits now.
Yeah. I see what you're saying.
Hits or even reading the paper.
Do you ask a reporter for, you know, I think that actually it's become almost second nature now for reporters to
know the difference.
To know, and because in part because you know what the traffic is during the day. At the beginning of our 3:30 meeting where we decide what is going to be on the front page every day, the first thing we look at is what the web traffic has been on various stories during the day. That's not, as the lawyers would say, dispositive. We don't make the decisions based upon that, but it is instructive. We get to learn something about what people find. Now, it's not the same audience, again, what's online as those who are reading in print, but it's worth knowing anyway.
Well, I wrote an article not that long ago for the Berkshire Eagle in my Saturday column about Yo-Yo Ma. And I immediately heard from the next day I heard from the editor, my friend Kevin Moran, who said to me, Alan, that was the most read thing in the paper that day.
Uh-huh.
And then, comma, pause, could you do it again?
Well, you know, Carr in his New York Times article says that even the critics of the current system, which is 24/7, lots of stories, not you wouldn't pick between the flag story and the housing story, mm-hmm. you'd be doing both.
Right.
No one really wants to go back to the old system, that was not a good way to cover campaigns. So take that as you're given before you go forward and talk about what it means that everything a candidate says or does or drops or spills on his suit becomes a news story.
The campaigns and the staffs of the politicians in the non-campaign season simply hate it because there are so many blogs now that cover everything that they say everything becomes a big deal. Everything gets out there and somebody has a chance to latch onto it and take offense. And therefore, candidates, they say, again, this is the articulation from the professionals, candidates become less genuine because they know that everything they do is a potential story.
You never know where that's going to happen. What is it, the 47% who didn't understand Romney? What was that? Those people will never understand. And it was done by apparently a waiter or something like that.
Yes, you're talking about the video that was made of Romney making the remark about 47% of the people dependent on government will not vote for him.
Yeah.
And that was done indeed by someone on the wait staff at the event he was speaking at.
But you never know, Rosemary, which of those things are going to take off.
Right. I mean, and Rex is right. What happens is you have candidates being so careful to make sure that that doesn't happen that they don't say anything. They even dress the way advisors tell them to. And so you end up with plastic, empty people that we can't really judge.
Well, yeah. And then, of course, there's something else that I think we might mention. The New York City mayoral campaign, which in Nacogdoches, Texas, may not be playing that big. But I can tell you that there's a man who is the public advocate, which is a nothing office. It's the number two office, but it doesn't have any real power. Mm-hmm. And he's a classic liberal, Bill de Blasio. And what has happened is that as he has pulled out in the polls,
coming out ahead of the other candidates,
he is gaining meta speed, so that there is a bandwagon effect, which is due to what the newspapers may be reporting the polls are saying.
Out where I come from, we call it the tumbleweed effect. You know, the tumbleweed rolls along and picks up whatever's in its trail, its path, I mean. But that's correct. And as stuff is, it becomes almost self-fulfilling. And that's why when a couple weeks ago, when you were saying that you really liked journalism that focused on polls, I was telling you that I didn't think it was such a good thing because you write about the polls. The polls take on added importance more than they need to have.
I like polls when they go my way. but I also think you make a good point. On the other hand, it's the way it is. Or as our governor has been known to say here in New York, just the way it is. So that's the way it is. And, you know, a new poll, Quinnipiac poll comes out, or in a close race, Rex, I doubt you're not going to have it somewhere in the paper.
Oh, absolutely. We're going to cover it. I'm thinking polls are a fine thing. I'm just saying that the over-reliance on them, it is really striking to me how much attention now polls, Marist Quinnipiac, Siena, for example, which are all based at universities right around the New York metropolitan area, are getting, how much attention they get when they come out with a poll that says this person has pulled 5 points ahead and suddenly the person is 8 points ahead. I don't know how you avoid that.
The two things, I think, Rex, that make for compelling reason in the newspapers are sex and polls.
Uh-huh. Well, They're great things.
Sort of the same as life.
Yeah, it is. You know, the thing about Twitter, too, is it is almost within the bubble. That is, everybody who is in the sort of inner circle of politics or inside the Beltway in Washington or in the circle of New York State politics and government or city politics pays a lot of attention to it, a lot more than ordinary citizens. And so it is amplified by virtue of the fact that there's a lot more social media adoption by the journalists, the politicians they cover, the staffs, most significantly, I think of that.
The staffs of the politicians.
Of the politicians. Mm-hmm. The top journalist for members of Congress, the person who is followed the most by members of Congress, is Mike Allen of Politico, formerly of the Washington Post.
Fascinating.
Yeah. It is interesting there. Yeah. Then comes Rachel Maddow of MSNBC.
But only for Democrats.
Is that right?
Yeah. The interesting part about this study, it's actually a study of the statistics on Twitter, mm-hmm. and it found that Democrats and Republicans, politicians, listen to and follow very different people
Their
on
own.
Twitter, except for Mike Allen. And so Rachel Maddow comes out number two.
You're
among,
right. Number two for
Democrats.
The Republicans is a guy from Fox News,
right.
Chad Pergram.
Right.
So isn't that interesting?
No, I don't like
so
him.
The interesting thing is that Allen is read on both sides. I read that story. It's very short. It's like just a couple paragraphs. And I'm not sure what the meaning of that is. I find it fascinating.
Well, I know what the meaning of it is.
What?
And that is that we tend to go where we're welcome. We've always said that. In other words, people might go to some hokey station here in Albany, which plays Rush Limbaugh and the rest of those guys all day long, because they know they're going to a like-minded place.
But what is Mike Allen writing about?
He created the genre. Actually, if you think about it, if you look at what we do in the morning, our wonderful Capitol reporter, Jimmy Vilken, there's the newsletter City and State from down in New York City. There's the Gotham Gazette. They put out morning newsletters. Mike Allen created this genre. He's the one who first put birthdays for politicians and staffers. If you look at the new book, which is a hot nonfiction seller this summer called This Town, about the culture of Washington, D.C. these days, written by the New York Times Magazine Washington correspondent Mark Leibovich, that book points out that, as he's known down in Washington, Mikey is everywhere and seemingly doesn't sleep, like Dr. Chartok, and is pretty much the guy that everybody follows. So that's just, he's sort of like
the Jim Romanesco in our media world. Everybody, he was the go-to place to find gossip and information.
I think we ought to be talking a little bit this week, if it's okay with you guys, about Syria.
Well, we were just about to make a neat segue to that, which is a term that I understand you people, you radio professionals know, because Syria is something where
we're not talking about Sirius. We're talking about Syria,
where we're relying on social media. By the way, if you're just joining us, this is the Media Project from Northeast Public Radio. Investigative journalist Rosemary Armeo, CEO of Northeast Public Radio, Alan Chartok, and I'm Rex Smith, editor of the Times Union in Albany, New York, from where this program originates. So we were about to say, it turns out that the way that people are actually getting access to information, the way that journalists are getting it first and policymakers, is an awful lot of social media. Evidence of the atrocities that are leading the United States government to say we're going to attack Syria came to John Kerry from social media.
Interesting. Could you give us an example?
Well, for example, I'm just talking about the chemical weapons attack. Apparently, John Kerry got word of that within 90 minutes of that happening by social media. And
I think
then
he testified, didn't he, that social media just went crazy like an
Absolutely.
Hour and a half after it was happening. It was evident to intelligence gatherers that something was going on.
And that's partly because for journalists, they can't really get there. Beirut, which is sort of on the border of Syria, is about as close as they can safely get. And Richard Engel of NBC News was taken hostage last year when he got into Syria. And he has recently been there, but most recently he's been broadcasting from the Turkey-Syrian border. So social media is about the only way you can get access to this.
Now, there's another side to this, of course, and that is when social media is irresponsible or inaccurate. And that happens with some regularity. I have been receiving telephone calls here about something that somebody having to do with a Guardian or something picked up, which is that somebody was interviewing one of the rebels who said, no, that was our gas, and it went wrong, and really, it was not the government, it was us. And it is now being treated as fact with these folks who are calling me up and saying, don't you know what really happened? No.
That is exactly the problem with social media, and this was just portrayed brilliantly on the newsroom.
The newsroom,
oh, God, I know. It's such a great show. Aaron Sorkin so has it right.
Sam Waterston.
He's wonderful in
he's
it.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
My friend.
They portrayed that whole idea so well. You want news on the war front. The war front's right in Damascus. It's right in the cities. It's in Aleppo, and we can't send reporters there, which is another whole story why it's so much harder to cover wars now than it used to be. So you rely on people, citizens, but you can't vet them the same way that you can reporters that you're sending in. You can't check their information as well. Mm. They send you photos and pictures and video, and those can all be doctored quite easily on social media. So do you go with it or not? It's a whole different world out there. It really is.
So do you think, guys, that I don't think an editorial in the New York Times means that much. For example, in an election, we see that right now. But do you think that since the Times is clearly read in the White House, that when they oppose, saying it's premature to go into a war with Syria or to start lobbying things to them, that it's more important than just a Times editorial on almost anything else because it's being read in the White House and it may affect policy?
What was the question?
Do you think, okay, it's a hard conceptual question, Rick, so you really have to concentrate
on it.
I didn't get it either, Rick,
yeah.
So I have to, yeah,
That goes for you too, Matt. That certainly goes for you too. So here's the deal. The New York Times editorializes every day, right?
Right.
You can take it or leave it. Obviously, New Yorkers, for example, in this election are leaving it. Because they made an endorsement.
The New York Times, the Daily News, and the Post all three endorsed Christine Quinn for mayor. She has not been, she's been falling in the polls. So they're
falling dramatically in the polls. So that's the leave it side, right?
Okay.
Now, so that's the New York, you know, people reading the Times and saying, okay, we agree with it or not. As opposed to the Times landing on Barack Obama's desk. And now it says, don't go in, Mr. President. It's too early. The facts aren't clear. Is that editorial much more important in that area than it is with the general population?
I suspect so. And certainly that's got to be on the minds of the Times editors in writing that kind of an editorial. Even though the White House is aware of the fact that, you know, we can go around the newspaper and go to the people directly, I think there's still some credibility that attaches in the policymakers' minds, in the minds of, let's say, the liberal elite, to a New York Times editorial.
Sure, if we haven't got the Times on our side, boy, that's not good. Mm-hmm. Says the Barack Obama, maybe.
I think that could be.
Where's Judith Miller when we need her?
And there are those people out there, Rosemary, who will not remember who Judith Miller was. So in one sentence, can you do that for us?
She was a New York Times reporter who supported the idea that there were weapons of mass destruction and that going to war in Iraq was a good idea. It turned out her sources were the same people who were talking to the White House, and they were no more reliable when talking to her than when talking to the White House. And the New York Times lent great credibility to the push to go to war. Did not do their job to question and to question the sources and the veracity of the reporting.
And it can have a huge impact, even though other reporters were raising significant questions at that point, you know, notably the McClatchy Bureau in Washington.
Absolutely.
And even in the last press conference before the invasion, if you look at the tape of that, the reporters were pushing Bush with tough questions. And he, of course, just came back with politicians learn to answer. Exactly. And the Times gave great credibility.
White House used what was in the Times. The Times used the White House supports what we're saying. And what you have was a collusion of the press and the government instead of what ought to be, you know, the adversarial role.
So traditional media and new media have their own places. Interesting. Okay, great discussion, folks. Sorry to have to,
That's it?
That's all.
Oh, my God.
That went fast.
How can this be? Rosemary Mayo, Alan Shartok, Rex Smith here for the Media Project. Let's listen to Pete a little bit more. Huh?
Okay.
And Rex and Rosemary, I know you join me in telling all our Jewish friends this week, Happy New Year.
Now you remember Mrs. Sadie Smuggery. She wanted money to buy a new fur coat. To get insurance, she employed skullduggery. She up and cut her husband's only throat. She chopped him into fragments, she stuffed him in a trunk. She shipped it all back yonder to her uncle in Podunk. Now newspapermen meet such interesting people. It must have startled poor old Sadie's unk. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, city desk.
Hold the press, hold the press. Extra, extra, read all about it. It's a mess meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. Their policy is an acrobatic thing. They claim to represent the common people. It's funny, Wall Street never has complained. Ah, but publishers have worries, for publishers must go to working folks for readers and to big shots for their dough. Now publishers are such interesting people. It could be prostitution, I don't know. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, circulation, ting-a-ling-a-ling, advertising, get those readers, get that payoff. What a headache, what a mess. Oh, publishers are such interesting people. Let's give 3 cheers for freedom of the press.